Before we get into today's episode, I want to invite you on a unique spiritual journey this Advent season. It's called Journey to Bethlehem, and it's a free 9-day text message series designed to prepare your heart for Christmas. Starting on December the 17th, and each day leading up to Christmas, you'll receive a short reflective message pointing you to the hope, peace, joy, and love found in the coming of Christ. It's completely free and a great way to keep your focus on Jesus this season. Sign up today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now here's today's podcast.
Hello and welcome along. I'm Justin Briley, your host for Unbelievable for the next hour and a half, the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for discussion and debate. It's a Christian non-Christian debate today of a scientific nature. So I'll be introducing my guests and the topic in just a moment's time. But first of all, thanks to all those who've been in touch over the last few weeks on different shows that we've had. And we're going to be hearing some of your responses to things like the question of Adam and Eve and whether they were a literal human pair, whether they were an archetype, and some of the different responses we've had to that programme between John Walton and Steve Lloyd. There was the Archbishop of Canterbury podcast special talking about evangelism and witness. Got some of your thoughts on that as well later on in the programme. Unbelievable is part of Faith Explored every Saturday here on Premier Christian Radio and brought to you in association with Premier Christianity magazine. If you'd like a free copy, go to premierchristianity.com/free sample. And well, later on Faith Explored, we're going to be hearing from Noel Robinson, the worship leader, on The Profile. That's between 4 and 5 this afternoon. If you want to know anything else about Unbelievable, then why not visit the webpage of the show, where you can find ways to get in touch and lots of past programs too. That's at premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. Right now, time to meet my guests.
You're unbelievable.
Well, welcome along to another edition of the show when we look at an issue in science, not just in science, but generally in the news recently, because there's a new theory going around that some say could overturn current Big Bang cosmology, which traditionally has been said to predict a beginning to the universe. Well, here's how one website reported this new theory. Science shocker, as physicists dispute Big Bang theory and admit the universe could be infinite. Well, I wonder what the actual science is behind this. We're going to have two people on the programme today who are going to help us to think through this. Does the idea that God created the universe, is that supported by Big Bang theory, you're going to be asking? Or has the Big Bang gone bust and buried God in the process? All that kind of stuff, which you can do fancy alliteration with, we'll be discussing on the programme today. There's been a lot of media interest, though, in the universe lately, hasn't there? Various theories about it recently. The Theory of Everything, of course, the film that's been on at the cinemas on the life of Stephen Hawking, has a sort of a science versus God sort of theme going around. And, of course, recently, the Massive Hadron Collider, the CERN thing, has come back online, so that's got a lot of people interested in the whole thing of the fundamental forces that make up the universe that we live in, and the beginning of the universe as well. Well, today on the programme, helping us to think through all this stuff, Jeff Zwierink of Reasons to Believe joins me. He's a physicist who believes that the latest scientific discoveries are consistently affirming the truth of Scripture, and he believes the scientific consensus around the Big Bang does support the idea that God created the universe, and we'll find out how he responds to this rival theory that I've mentioned. Phil Harper, known online as Skydance Phil, is a critic of those who hold to cosmological arguments that invoke the Big Bang, and he's got a number of videos online and believes that Christian apologists actually rarely understand the actual physics that they're talking about when it comes to these sorts of arguments. So it's great to have you both with me on the programme, gentlemen.
Thanks, Justin. Great
good to be here
again.
Yeah.
Great to have you both. Let's first of all talk to you, Phil, I think, as someone who came on around about the end of last year talking about animal suffering. Yeah. That was a really interesting edition of the programme. But this is the thing that probably you're most interested in terms of the amount of stuff you've done around it online, because you've sort of taken it as a personal project to kind of criticise Christian apologists who use Big Bang cosmology as in some way evidence for the existence of God. When did you kind of first run into this, and was it already your interest, if you like, the kind of physics of the universe and so on?
Yeah, I've always been interested in this question. It's such a a fascinating question. Did the universe have a beginning or not? And I would love to know the answer. And unfortunately, we don't know the answer. And it seems to me that it's not just Christian apologists that I think give a false impression. There are secular scientists as well that also, I think, give a false impression that the Big Bang has proven that the universe had a beginning. But I think when we, you know, talk about these things, we need to clarify what we mean by Big Bang. And we'll come on to that in a second.
Yes, of course.
But we decided, you know, that there was a lot of misconceptions out there. So we actually contacted some of the top cosmologists in the world and came up with some ideas for making films about their ideas. And we've made three films in a series called Before the Big Bang. One looks at loop quantum cosmology. Another has an interview with Sir Roger Penrose about his new ideas. And the other interviews various string theorists, including the inventor of string theory.
And did you start getting into Unbelievable after hearing a program on Big Bang at some point?
I was studying astronomy with one of your other guests, Norman Hansen.
And
he told me about the show.
Oh, there you go. So that was the connection.
Yeah.
Well, and in obviously, if it's not already apparent, you are an atheist, personally, in terms of your beliefs. But in a sense, you're very against, I guess, theologians of any persuasion using science to kind of make theological conclusions.
Yeah, well, it wasn't just me that said that. Georges Lemaître, who was the guy that sort of came up with the idea of the Big Bang in the 1920s, he was a priest in the Catholic Church, and the Pope wanted to use the Big Bang as proof of God, and he objected very strongly. He said, that's a very bad idea.
Please don't put it to that use.
Yeah.
Right, interesting stuff. We'll come to this story that I mentioned about whether the cosmology has been overturned in terms of the theories and so on around the Big Bang. But first of all, quick introduction to Jeff Swearink, our other guest, who's, again, no stranger to this programme, has been on a few times over the years. Jeff, thanks for coming on the programme today.
It's good to be back here today, Justin.
Tell us a little bit about what Reasons to Believe stands for. You really do believe that current scientific evidence and the more discoveries we have, the more they confirm what you believe is the account of how the world came to be and so on.
Yeah, it really is. And it's kind of born out of a conviction that if God exists and he's the creator of the universe and the inspiration for scripture, then what we find as we look at and study the Bible and what we find as we look at study creation are going to say the same thing. And so, you know, and particularly relevant to this issue is one of the things that seems a cornerstone of how the Bible describes the universe is that it had a beginning. And so I would expect that as we, and RTB would expect that as we go out and look at the universe, we will find evidence that makes that a rational and reasonable conclusion to draw.
Well, maybe you could start off by kind of maybe elucidating what this particular challenge to the current Big Bang cosmology is, because as I kind of my bold quotes a headline of science shocker as physicists dispute Big Bang theory and admit the universe could be infinite. Do you want to just give us an idea of where this has come from and what exactly it's being proposed as an alternative to?
Yeah, I do. And I would just kind of preface it by one comment. I think Phil might have alluded to it there is, you know, what do we mean by the Big Bang? And if you're talking about generally just, you know, going from a few moments or from the earliest moments of what we can tell about the universe and looking at its development onward, people talk about that generally as Big Bang cosmology. And that, I think, is on very solid ground. I think what is specifically relevant to this discussion is the notion of when you go and push into those earliest moments, do you actually run into a beginning where the laws of physics break down and you're required to invoke something beyond the laws of physics, which would be consistent with God, where there would be a beginning. And so that's where this new discovery or this new paper is really talking about is what's going on in those earliest moments and do we really run into a singularity where there's a beginning to things? And so what this study is getting at, and it is a well-known and long-standing problem in science in general, is that we've got these two very prominent, well-tested theories. You've got general relativity, which describes the gravity and the general dynamics of the universe, and then you've got quantum mechanics, which describes the physics of the very small, if you will. And when they're fundamentally incompatible. And so the problem with saying there's a Big Bang or science demands that there's this Big Bang singularity is that right where you need general relativity to be correct is precisely the moment where it breaks down and you need to bring in quantum mechanics. And so people are looking to how do you get this general quantum gravity theory and what does it say about the beginning? And the short answer is we just don't have that answer. So I concur and agree with Phil there that we just don't have that final definitive answer at this point. And that's one of the things that this paper is highlighting.
Sure. Okay. Well, we can get into a bit more about the paper in a moment's time. But you're still confident, even though there is obviously inevitably a lot of mystery about exactly what's going on at these very, very earliest stages of the universe's development, that you're still happy to say that there is evidence that God, if you like, initiated all this.
Yeah, I am still comfortable with that. And, you know, I kind of look at it from a historical perspective as, you know, you look back at, you know, start of the 1900s, the universe was eternal, it existed forever. Einstein proposes theory of general relativity, you know, various people looking at what that means, and it looks like there's a beginning. And so they said, well, do we need to have a beginning? And maybe there's this steady state cosmology where it's expanding, but new matter is coming into existence. Well, eventually the data showed that that wasn't correct. So maybe it's oscillating. And now eventually found the cosmic microwave background radiation and showed that, no, lo and behold, it does seem like there's still a beginning. And so, you know, you got the space-time theorems of general relativity, again, that if general relativity is valid, it says that there's a beginning. You know, you come to the 80s and 90s and you have this idea of a multiverse. And when the multiverse came out, again, it seemed to push back and say, no, it could be eternal again. And lo and behold, again, the data still seems to indicate there's a beginning. So I do think it's a very reasonable conclusion to draw that the idea that our universe has a beginning is a reasonable conclusion to draw, even if not definitively proven at this point.
Sure. And if it did have a beginning, that provides evidence towards, you know, something that, if you like, had to begin it, if you like. It's crying out for some kind of an explanation beyond itself in that sense. Phil, great to have you back on the show. So, again, we're going to try and keep this as easy as possible for as many people
we'll try
to understand. We've already talked about general relativity and quantum mechanics. But what's your understanding of what this new theory is? Is it as new as they're claiming? It sounds like it's actually been around for a while.
Well, it isn't. It isn't. So what's new is what they've tried to do is look at sort of the trajectory of particles as you trace back the evolution of the universe.
Hmm.
So in general relativity, you would say they all come together in this singularity.
Mm-hmm.
But general relativity assumes what we call a classical space-time. So as Jeff rightly pointed out, you need to bring in quantum mechanics. So this is what they've tried to do and change the trajectories of these particles with quantum mechanics. And quantum mechanics has very weird counterintuitive things going on in it. So we shouldn't expect it to necessarily replicate what happens in general relativity. So what they've done is put these quantum trajectories into the equations and try and recover the standard cosmological equations at sort of normal times, which is what they have to do because they stand up. So they've shown, or what they claim to show, is that they can do that in a mathematically rigorous way, and they also claim that they can predict the dark energy, which is something which is believed to be pushing the universe apart at an accelerated rate. And if that's the case, that's really quite something.
Mm.
But this idea, I spoke to Surya Das, who's the author of this paper, on Skype the other night, and he basically said the basic idea is that as you get close to singularity, you have this sort of repulsive force. So quantum mechanics kicks in and actually stops these things coming together in this singularity,
right,
which means singularities can't form and therefore the universe is eternal into the past. Now, what's very interesting is that other people using quantum theories have come to the same conclusion already. So when I first heard this, I kind of shrugged my shoulder and went, yeah, we already knew that.
Okay.
When I say we knew that, I mean other quantum theories have suggested this. We don't know it as a fact.
Well, so boiling this down to, as it were, what this means for people who maybe believe that the Big Bang cosmology does give some evidence for God. Effectively, a lot of people have said, you know, William Lane Craig, for instance, in his Kalam cosmological argument, say, you know, if it can be shown that the universe has a beginning in time and space and matter and everything else had a beginning, we've got good grounds for believing that that kind of a thing needs a cause. Therefore, we can posit something beyond the Big Bang in that sense, i.e. something that set it all off. The best explanation is God. Okay, you can see how attractive that is as a kind of evidence for God. And if you like, I've often heard that some secular atheist scientist kind of at the time the Big Bang was being proposed back in the 1960s or whatever, were kind of didn't like it because of the potential sort of implications it had for a view of creation, if you like. But from your point of view, do you feel like it ever had that kind of implication? You're shaking your head. You're saying you don't even think it ever really got off the ground.
Yeah, well, let's put it this way. People like Roger Penrose and Stephen Hawking that came out with these singularity theorems, they were atheists then. They believed those theorems for many decades. Both Hawking and Penrose have abandoned the theorems, not in terms of the mathematics of the theorems, but whether they actually apply to the universe. Roger Penrose now thinks the universe is eternal into the past. We made a film with him. William Lane Craig said that the model was not eternal into the past, but Roger Penrose says it was. He hasn't changed his religious views at all. And I think the idea is if there is a beginning to the universe, then the notion of causality is hard to maintain, because things that have beginnings have prior moments in time. But if the universe didn't have a prior moment in time, then it's not clear that you need a cause. Now, that's something we can talk about. Mm. But I think the really important thing to stress is that when people like William Lane Craig say the Big Bang proves a beginning, that's really playing loose with the term Big Bang. We need to clarify what we mean. So there's two definitions. One is that the Big Bang is this evolution from a hot, dense state, and we can call that the Big Bang phase. The other definition is it's an evolution from an infinitely hot and infinitely dense state, which is what the singularity theorems say.
Sure. And, now, and that would suggest a beginning of time, space, yes, and matter.
Yes.
But evolution from a very dense state, but one that's not necessarily infinitely dense
because
and infinitely hot, it is not necessarily that simply could be seen as something going back eternally in that sense.
Absolutely. So what's common, what people want to do is they want to develop a quantum theory of gravity and apply it to the Big Bang and then find out what happened. So there are sort of multiple approaches to quantum gravity, but as far as I know, there's only three that have been applied to the Big Bang. So one is called loop quantum gravity, and that tells you that the Big Bang was really a bounce. So basically, as you get to this very high density, this repulsive quantum force kicks in, much like a sponge. Imagine you've got a sponge, you pour water on it, and it absorbs water. But eventually the sponge gets filled up, and the water sort of repels.
Right.
So in loop quantum gravity, this is exactly what happens. So eventually the density gets so high that the space can't contain it anymore, and it repels it.
Mm.
So you get a bounce. And on the other side is it just a contracting classical space-time. There's another theory called Hajava-Lipschitz gravity, and that has exactly the same conclusion. And the other, of course, the most famous one is string theory. In string theory, you've got a bit more complicated situation. There are different models inspired by string theory, but nevertheless, you see the bounce solution multiple times in different models in string theory. So that suggests that this is possibly what's going on, but of course we don't know yet.
Right.
And we have to wait
and
see.
I think you've done really well at kind of trying to keep that in reasonably layperson's terms. But, and so your challenge is to continue in that mould, Jeff. is this a kind of a fair summing up of where the science is at the moment? Jeff, what's your take on this?
No, I agree with his assessment, or Phil's assessment, that this is really, to answer this question well, we need to have a quantum theory of gravity. And the fact of the matter is, right now we don't. And so there are numbers of different approximations or attempts or tries of doing that. The question that is difficult is, what is that quantum theory of gravity? And I think Phil rightly states that there are, in at least some of these, you get this idea that you don't get the singularity. And so it's an open question. And quite honestly, that's one thing that as an apologist, I've been a little conscious of when talking about a beginning, or at least tried to be conscious of, is the recognition that lacking a quantum theory of gravity, we can't make that statement. But I do think it is provocative that it's intriguing that over the last 100 years, there does seem to be a lot of evidence, or at least evidence that makes it reasonable to say that there might be a beginning in spite of not having this final quantum theory of gravity.
Yes, if you like, given that what was on the cards was a sort of the universe has basically always been around a bit like the way we experience it now, you obviously had something very different proposed, which was at one point the universe was very tiny, about 13.7 billion years ago or whatever.
We have to be careful. It's the observable universe. It's very tiny.
Right.
We don't know what the whole universe is. It could be infinite. We don't know.
Well, that's an interesting one to throw in. But I mean, okay. So Jeff, does the fact that we don't have a kind of, there are different theories out there about what the quantum mechanics might be of the beginning of the universe, does that, you know, fundamentally, as Phil would say, undermine the view that God is the best explanation for where the universe came from? Because as far as Phil's concerned, there's absolutely no evidence that the universe came from anywhere in as much as it could have always been here on all of these different theories of the very early state of the universe.
Well, that's an interesting question, I have to say, because, you know, I think at the end of the day, Phil and I are both looking at the same set of data, the same knowledge base that we have there. And my inclination is to walk away and say, yeah, I think it's reasonable to believe there's a beginning. And his inclination is to walk away and say, no, I don't think there is evidence for a beginning. And so, you know, there's that question of, why are we looking at the same stuff here and coming away with a different conclusion? You know, I think for what I find instructive, or what weighs heavily on my mind, is one, I think it's hard to get away from the fact that we both do have some vested interest in what we would like it to be the case. But I also think that when I look at things historically, I mean, I've been through at least a couple of times where we're having this new thing that comes out that seems to get away from a beginning, or seems to not have a beginning, you know, in particular the multiverse and kind of string theory. And when we've been able to make some advances, it still has at least made it reasonable to believe there's a beginning. You know, I'll put it in the context of the multiverse. You know, we had this idea that our universe arises from this vacuum energy that inflates very rapidly and decays and makes universes. And once that process started, it seems to go on forever. Well, people thought, well, if it went on forever, maybe it's gone on, or it has always gone on forever. And so you end up with an eternal universe. Well, you know, in the context of that, you've got this Bordet-Vilenkin and Guth theorem, which says that, no, it still seems to have a past boundary, or there's a past boundary. And what's interesting is that Guth still looks at it as being eternal, and Vilenkin says there's a beginning. So even those two people who are very intimately aware of all the details still have a different conclusion there. And I just think it's kind of an interesting discussion that we don't seem to have the data to give a definitive answer one way or the other.
Are you kind of happy to say that there's, you know, it's also fully on the table, Jeff, that the universe did have a beginning, I guess, taking the Vilenkin camp, if you like, of the Guth and Vilenkin, that for you, that's still a perfectly reasonable kind of way to look at the science, and is a good competitor with those that say the universe is in some sense eternal because there's always been this, you know, other types of quantum loop gravity or whatever going on before the inflationary period.
I do. I think I find that there are good reasons to believe there's a beginning to the universe. But I also can understand, I mean, I look at Phil's position and I can see why he would walk away and say, yeah, there's good reason to believe there's not a beginning to the universe. So I think it is on the table, and it's reasonable to believe either side. But ultimately, we need to find that quantum theory of gravity that will give us a more definitive answer that doesn't allow us to just choose which one we want, if you will. And I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. I just mean that right now, I just don't think the data is definitive one way or the other.
Okay. And I mean, if they did find something that everyone could then agree on, say, that did at some level show that, in fact, the universe didn't have a beginning that you could pinpoint, Would you kind of then remove that sort of plank, if you like, of you know, what is, you know, a lot of what reasons to believe put as the modern scientific discoveries that support the notion that the Bible talks about a beginning of the universe and so on.
That, well, it would require me to really seriously evaluate whether the Bible's an accurate description of things or not. I've asked that question: how strongly does the Bible talk about the universe have a beginning? And you know, you've got Genesis 1:1. You know, in the beginning God created, and it may be there's ancient Near Eastern cultures, and that's not really talking about the physical realm, but you've got lots of passages in the New Testament that really do seem to say that the universe was created and that it had a beginning, that the idea of creation ex nihilo is a pretty prominent description, pretty prominent Christian doctrine. And so it would really force me to really evaluate, does the Bible accurately describe things? Yeah, that's, I think that's the level of seriousness I would put to that question. So,
I mean, you've turned your mind to the theological issues as well, haven't
yes.
you, Phil?
Can I just make one little point about the Bode Guth-Vilenkin theorem?
Sure.
It's been used so much in apologetic circles. If you Google that theorem, it's almost all Christian apologists or atheist articles about it. There's very few. Well, there should be technical articles coming up, but that's not what happens. So that theorem is purely in the context of classical general relativity. And it's easily violated if you have a prior contracting universe, which is what it seems virtually all the quantum gravity theory tells you is what is happening. So it's very hard to say that that is evidence of a beginning. It's a theorem. Whether the theorem actually applies to the universe, we don't know. Now, the data doesn't tell us anything about whether there was an absolute beginning. The data all tells us that there was some kind of Big Bang event. But the nature of that event, whether it was really the beginning, the data tells us absolutely nothing about. And in fact, we interviewed David Wands, who's a cosmologist at Portsmouth, in our string theory film, and he said singularity theorems can't make predictions. You know, if it was infinitely curved, infinitely dense, how do you predict anything for the CMB or any other observable?
Interesting. What about the Bible itself? Okay. And from that perspective, do you think that you know, theologians are onto a good thing if we do have a beginning of the universe because it matches nicely with the Bible, or do you even dispute that?
Yeah, I would dispute that. So,
I thought you might.
Yeah, of course. I'm So I watched Jeff's video about the Big Bang, and he said, you know, it says in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and that this is a compound Hebrew word that basically we should interpret as the universe. But you know, I went to Hebrew school, and I remember certain words very, very well, like the word Eretz, because we used to sing these Jewish Hebrew songs, Eretz Israel. It means land, and Hashemayim means the sky. So you can really think of that as in the beginning, God created the land and the sky. And if you look at the ancient cosmologists at the time, the Sumerians, the Babylonians, it's very, very common nomadic people, even if you interview them today. What they think of is the universe is like a flat disk. Above them is the sky, and then above that is like a solid firmament, and above that is water. And when you read the Bible, you see, and it is common in Sumerian myths as well, that actually there seems to be water from the get-go, because God moved over the face of the waters. It really doesn't say that God created the universe from nothing. There was debates with rabbinical schools about whether there was creation ex nihilo or not, and they couldn't agree with each other. Some said it was, some said it wasn't. The Hillel school of rabbinical tradition thought the earth was created before the heavens. They knew Hebrew.
Okay, yeah. we'll let Jeff respond to that in a moment's time, because we're just coming up on a break now, and that would be an interesting place to pick it up again. Talking about, was God behind the Big Bang, and really having a bit of a technical discussion about what the Big Bang even consists of, and whether you can, if you like, use it as evidence towards a creator. So my guests today, Jeff Swearink of Reasons to Believe, and Phil Harper, known online as Skydance Phil.
Skydive Phil.
Skydive. Why did I say dance? Skydive Phil. Because he does skydiving in his spare time.
Yeah.
But we'll be back in a moment's time as we continue to unpack this this topic.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories. Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
In our Easter edition, find out why science is shedding new light on the death and resurrection of Jesus as we investigate the Turin Shroud and an autopsy of the crucifixion. Plus, meditation isn't just for Buddhists. Discover why Christians are getting into mindfulness. And we respond to Stephen Fry getting angry with God. All that plus news, reviews and your favourite columnists.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So today on Unbelievable, with me, Justin Briley, we're talking about the beginning of the universe. And does the science show that it had a beginning in space and time? Or could it have been eternal in the past? Because this is a big deal in Christian apologetics. It's often been used as evidence for the existence of a creator God. The idea that, you know, if the universe began to exist, you know, just under 14 billion years ago, that seems to provide a lot of kind of, well, a big question mark about where it came from. Could there have been a cause? Was that cause God, and so on? We could get into all that as well, but primarily we've been just trying to work out with my guest today, Jeff Swearing of Reasons to Believe, and Phil Harper, whether you know, the cosmologies do talk about a beginning. And as we've heard, different people have different views, and it depends if you believe that general relativity breaks down at the tiniest level when you get to that very, very hot, small state of the universe. I mean, I to be honest, guys, I just find it extraordinary that once the universe was the size of a pea or something. You know, that to me is just mind-bogglingly
It was enormously smaller than a pea.
Well, exactly,
universe.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. But I mean, that's the point, though. It is just the strangest thing anyway, and in that sense is entirely mysterious to me at some level anyway. But anyway, nonetheless, it's kind of actually quite easy to get to that kind of level, the P level. Yeah. It's once you go to this incredibly smaller level of how
right,
all of matter and energy and everything fits into that, you know. And as you say, that some level, what we talk about, the big physics of the universe breaks down at that point. We've been talking, though, in that last section, Jeff, and Phil saying, you know, he doesn't think the Bible anyway really does affirm a beginning, a creation ex nihilo. It's all about what's going on in Genesis is some sort of order out of chaos, some kind of, you know, whatever the ancients believed was the kind of cosmological setup. But it doesn't kind of cohere with a kind of there was nothing and then God created. It's that he was kind of, I guess, moving stuff around that was already there and reordering it and so on. What's your take on that?
Well, I guess there's a sense to where, you know, you can have this discussion of whether there's a beginning scientifically, and then there's also a discussion of what is Genesis specifically talking about. And there are, even amongst Christian scholars who are talking about this, there are people who would say that, oh yeah, Genesis 1 is talking about a beginning, and others saying, no, it's not talking about the material world at all. So I think if you just restrict yourself to Genesis, yeah, there are these open questions. But I do know that when you look at the entire canon, the Old and the New Testament, and what do Christians have to say, that this idea of creation ex nihilo, that God creating the universe out of nothing, you know, you get that from John 1, you get it from Colossians 1, you get it from Hebrews 1, and whether Genesis 1 was talking about that or not, it's at least consistent. That the idea that God creates the universe out of nothing is something that is the historic Christian view. I mean, you can argue that maybe that's wrong, but that is historically what Christianity has thought. And so, you know, it does seem like it is a pretty sound, that's the tradition of what people have said that's meant in the scriptures. And so lacking the theological expertise to go in and dissect that, you know, I will take that at the face value, that's what biblical scholars who do have that expertise walk away with.
So taking the whole of scripture, then you believe there's a good case for saying that it does see, yeah, a kind of a creation ex nihilo in that sense. I suppose that then moves us on to the question of whether there could have, you know, been a cause before time, if you like, because if we do say take as a given the Bård Guth-Wilenkin version of events, in which, you know, there is a boundary and somehow space-time begins at that point, you're still not convinced that this would give rise, Phil, to being able to talk about a cause of that, presumably. You've got issues on
yeah,
that as
I
well.
Do. I mean, as I say, so when we think about cause and effect, if I asked you what were the causes of World War II, you'd think of World War I, you know,
yeah.
It happened beforehand. You know, whenever I ask you what was the cause of something, you're going to be referring to something that happened beforehand. So causes have prior moments in time. If the universe had a beginning, that means there was no prior moment of time. And therefore, it's not clear that we can still talk about causality. Another thing that might be missing is the laws of physics themselves. So if you saw, you know, a smashed glass on the floor, spilt wine, you say, what caused that? Or someone dropped it, you would say. Okay, but you can only say that because the law of gravity exists. If there's no laws of physics and no prior time, I'm not quite sure how we can demand that there's still causality. And we also have the other issue. Vilenkin takes the view that quantum mechanics implies that there is a breakdown of causality. He's very, very clear. He says that, that he thinks the universe did come from nothing, as it were. And he's very clear that the quantum mechanics allows spontaneous creation of the universe. Now, he might be wrong, you know, but I think it casts at least enough doubt to say, you know, we really can't talk about causality with any confidence, you know, if there is this beginning. I think the best way to frame it, I like the way Sean Carroll phrases it, where he says, it's not that the universe popped out of nothing if there was a beginning. It's just it has a first moment in time. There wasn't a prior time where there was nothing. See, it's so hard to imagine. You know, we think of, you know, we watch the animations of the Big Bang and we see this empty space and this explosion. But that's not the right way to think about
it. Right. What is the right way to think about this as far as you're concerned, Jeff?
Well, I mean, there's the question in here that is relevant for discussion. You know, we talk about causality, and I think those are all important things. But what I would ask the question is the way Christian doctrine and theology describes this, is it consistent? You know, so the idea that God exists outside of time and can bring something into existence, it may be that our normal way of looking at things may break down and we have to look at things a different way. But if God is a all-powerful being who can create space and time and matter and energy, then there's no inconsistency there. You know, it may be, I guess I agree, maybe we have to rethink what causality means beyond that, but that's not inconsistent with a God bringing it into existence. So, you know, I do think it's important to ask the question, is this inconsistent with what we know? And the fact that God exists outside of time, and I would argue what we see as the laws of physics are a reflection of how reliably he sustains creation. So, you know, God is not somehow constrained by time or the laws of physics to be able to describe that. He exists outside of those and brings them into existence. And so there's no inconsistency there, at least from looking at that. Now, the question is that a right picture? That's a different discussion. And, you know, I think one we're wrestling with here is there really beginning and do we have to deal with that?
It sounds like what you're saying, Jeff, is something along the lines of, look, yeah, of course, once you get back to a point where time doesn't exist effectively, you're obviously talking about, if you're talking about a creation, a creator, a cause, it's going to be a very different kind of cause to the types we're familiar with at some level, but you still see somehow it needs an explanation that goes beyond itself. It you can't just say, well, it just was, you know, that's just what happened, sort of thing.
Yeah, I think if all there is the material, then that becomes a problem. But if, you know, if God indeed exists, that's consistent, that fits comfortably with how the Bible describes him. So I don't see any logical inconsistency there.
Any come back on this?
Well, a couple of things I want to pick up on. One, it's interesting that Jeff was talking about the God as the sustainer of the universe, because an interesting thing I want to point out is that when the steady state theory was quite popular back in the 1940s, a lot of theologians thought it was proof of God because they thought he was sustaining the universe with this continual creation. So it seems the problem is that God is, you know, ill-defined, and therefore you can make him fit basically absolutely anything that you want. And that's kind of why I think, you know, people who tend to have a more scientific mindset don't really like the concept of God. It's not that they hate God. It's just they can't get anything out of it because he can do anything. And therefore, anything that you observe or come up with can be consistent with God, is logically consistent with him because he can do anything.
Is that fair, Jeff?
I would say conceptually, yes. And so I think Phil raises a good point, though, is, okay, if God can do anything, then the question is, what do we look at that might say he is or isn't there? And, you know, that's a little more difficult because now you have to pin down and say, all right, how has God revealed himself to us that we might be able to address that question? You know, I think the Bible is an accurate revelation of God. And so that's where I'm kind of looking through scripture saying, all right, what is it that I can hang my hat on and say, okay, really what I expect to find. And I think the beginning, or, you know, a creation ex nihilo, some sort of creation ex nihilo, is one of those places where the scripture seems to be that clear that if the universe, or that if God exists, the universe does have a beginning in some way. And so that's why I think this discussion is very relevant, even if we don't have the complete answers, because I think that is one of those things that if we find the universe has simply existed forever, I think that's very problematic for Christianity.
Well, look, you're listening to an edition of Unbelievable today in which we're talking about God and the Big Bang. Big subjects, both of them. So I hope you're following along. And if you want more information, do go online to where you can find today's program at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can leave your comments underneath today's show, if you like, and see what other people are saying about it. Or indeed, you can send them to me on Facebook and Twitter at unbelievablejb and facebook.com/unbelievablejb to follow the show. Links to both Phil and Jeff from today's show, of course. And if you want to email in, a slightly more traditional way of getting in touch with me, I'll be reading some of those out later on in today's show from recent shows, and you can send in your thoughts about today. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
One thing I did want to touch on, gentlemen, and, you know, you're both primarily interested in the science of this, but one thing, for instance, when William Lane Craig has presented very often on the Kalam cosmological argument, he has said it's not, although this is often what gets focused on, it's not just about the Big Bang in terms of this issue of the universe having a beginning. He believes that logically, philosophically, you cannot have an eternal universe because, philosophically speaking, it all breaks down conceptually if you try and think about that time having gone on forever in the past, because you'd never get to us if time went back forever, if you like, is a kind of a simple way of putting it. Does that particular way of looking at things, because I think that was what kind of really sparked it in his mind, was how the philosophy he'd been looking at of how you can't seem to have an eternal regression in the past seemed to match to him the scientific evidence that the universe had a beginning, and so he formed what, you know, many people call now the Kalam cosmological argument. So is there a philosophical issue here at work, Phil, or do you just not kind of deal with that?
No. I think we should deal with that. I'm not one of these people that think we shouldn't talk about philosophy.
Okay.
I don't want to put philosophers down at all. So I think the problem is before the 20th century, that might have seemed like a reasonable argument. The problem is with the discovery of general relativity and the sort of mechanism of how you actually get a beginning of time, which is these singularities. Mm. What you find is that in the singularity, you have infinite curvature, infinite temperature, infinite pressure, and infinite density. So it looks like you can't really get away from infinity so easily by just denying the infinite past. It looks like you might have to face infinity no matter what. Also, William Lane Craig has admitted, I think, that he needs an A theory of time. I won't bore you with what that is, but okay, there's different conceptions of time. And in particular, relativity teaches us that there is no unique now, that what you think is now is not necessarily what other people think is now. You can think something happened before, I can think it happened after, and we can both be right. There's this what's called the relativity of simultaneity. Mm. So there is not this certain notion of now, and that implies a sort of different conception of time than what we're used to. Mm. And his conception of time, the A theory, is the least supported theory out of philosophers. There have been surveys on this. I think something like 16% of philosophers endorse his theory, and the others, you know, have higher support. And actually, you know, if you watch our video with Roger Penrose, we actually asked him this very direct question: how can you traverse the infinite? He said, well, you know, people can't traverse the infinite. We can't. However, massless particles can, because they don't feel the passage of time. So if we think about the eternal universe, it's obviously people will not be going back into the eternal past, but massless particles, 1 second, 1 hour, a billion years, it's all the same to them.
Sure. Still, the very concept of an infinite regression seems somehow, I mean, I can see how that seems kind of logically almost absurd at some level, because you do run into logical absurdities, it seems, when you're talking about time, but maybe it does, as you say, at the quantum level, maybe that does break down somehow in terms of the way time is experienced.
Well, in a lot of these models, it's not the quantum space-time that's eternal. I mean, there's a very brief moment of a quantum space, a classical space-time on the other side. But mathematicians don't seem to have problems with infinities. And if you go to cosmology conferences, and you can watch videos online of these conferences and watch people debate these issues, you know, is the universe eternal or not? And nobody says, well, I mean, these guys know mathematics very, very well. Roger Penrose, John Barrow, you know, these guys understand mathematics very well. None of them say, oh, we're going to rule that out because of mathematical impossibility.
Right. What do you make of those who say that, philosophically speaking, it's very hard to see how you could have an eternal past, Jeff?
You know, I got to say, it's something that seems to resonate with me, but I also say that's, you know, I'm inclined to agree with it. So I've had to think a little bit about that. You know, and you wrestle with these, you know, as Phil mentioned, the simultaneity of events and what does time mean? And I think, you know, there's part of me is just fascinated by that. I think things are infinitely more complicated than what I would like them to be sometimes. And I think that's part of what's fun about trying to understand the universe is that it's simple enough that we can get a handle on it, but not so simple that we can ever really understand everything. And so that's what I love about science is that there's always new things to learn and grow and understand. That being said, I do wonder, how do we wrestle with things being infinite? You know, can you, you know, not that people are traversing things, but if things seem to, or if the universe is eternal, why are things changing here? You know, there are these odd things that, not that, you know, regardless of what the percentages of people that look at it this way or this way, or, you know, whether it's A theory or B theory, those sorts of things. But I do think there's a lot of interesting, complicated things that, again, I don't think there's a final answer one way or the other, but I do think they raise problems. So, you know, how do... If we have this actual conception of time, if time really is, there is no tense, there's no before and after, why do we see that as so fundamental? You know, that's something I think needs to be addressed if we're going to look at it that way. So, and the physics forces us to look at it that way, because as far as the laws of physics go, there is no before and after, there is just now, There isn't a tensed view. And so there are these things that we do have to wrestle with that we don't have a good explanation for. And so, you know, I'm willing to just put it out there and say, all right, let's keep investigating. I think it's reasonable to look at things and say, all right, there's a beginning. It's reasonable to look at things and say, yeah, we perceive time this way. But, you know, I don't think I'm forced into a conclusion at this point. But nothing in there... In what we know forces me to say, okay, God really can't be there. I think God is a very reasonable explanation for what we see and the science that we found. So,
well, look, I'd be interested to take this to kind of a level which maybe breaks it a little bit out of the fundamental theoretical level to what people are trying to do on the ground today. As I mentioned, the Big Hadron Collider is...
Large Hadron Collider.
I'm getting all the terminology wrong today. The Large Hadron Collider is back in action. They turned it back on recently. Now, tell me, and I don't know who answers this, but what are they actually looking for in the first place? I know that they seem to have confirmed the existence of the Higgs boson particle, which was up till now just a sort of theoretical, if you like, thing. But they seem to have seen that because of being able to do what they do. Is it going to help in any way with solving any of these mysteries about the beginning of the universe? Phil first, maybe.
Okay. Actually, I just want to correct myself. I think I said nobody thinks that infinity is prohibitive. That's probably going too far. There may be one or two people. But anyway, so to come to the question about the LHC. So basically what the LHC, the question is that this is a project for particle physicists, not really for cosmology. What they want to know is what are the fundamental constituents of matter? Mm-hmm. And so they smash things together and look at the debris. Now, it could be that they find some exotic new physics. So people are hoping to find evidence of supersymmetry and extra dimensions, and that would be really exciting. But it wouldn't necessarily tell us, you know, what happened at the Big Bang. There are other projects that I think would be more relevant. Mm. So looking at the cosmic microwave background, what we would like to see next, I think, is a dedicated polarization space-based mission. So there are proposals for projects called PRISM, CORE. These would be the next generation of CMB satellites. That would be much more appropriate.
These would be probing sort of far back into the universe's history to see what was trying.
Yeah, so they're looking at the cosmic microwave background, which we've already looked at. Mm. But the next, what they've been looking at before is sort of temperature differences, they're called anisotropies.
Yeah, yeah.
But the next thing to look at is the polarization. Mm. And there would be brilliant to have a new space-based mission for that. Then there's something much more ambitious, because the real signal from the very early, so when we look at the early universe, unfortunately, there's kind of a wall in the way. That wall is the cosmic microwave background. And so it's emitted 380,000 years after the Big Bang. And you can't see through it. So that's the earliest light that we can see. Mm. But there could be gravitational waves that would go straight through that wall. And if we could see those, that would be amazing. So there's one way to see it is indirectly through this polarization. Mm. But there's something even more ambitious, which have space-based missions to look for these gravitational waves. So there's something being launched this year called LISA Pathfinder, and that's going to test technology for this ambitious space-based project called LISA. But what I've heard is that LISA, which is scheduled to be launched, I think, in the 2030s, is not going to be anywhere near powerful enough. It has, I think, two or three spacecraft. It was three, and I think they've changed it to two. There's another project which will be the successor to LISA, called Big Bang Observer, and that would be sensitive enough to actually sort of see these gravitational waves, which could really help us distinguish between all these different competing ideas. That needs 12 spacecraft.
Okay.
So you can imagine this project is not going to happen anytime soon. But fingers crossed,
right.
You know, get a campaign going, fund this project.
And sounds like it could be even more expensive than CERN if it were ever to happen. Okay, Jeff, any hopes from your perspective that any of these physical experiments could eventually help us to understand the beginning of the universe better?
Well, I think, in addition to what Phil has brought up, I think there's a couple that may give us, if we're lucky, they may give us some insight, is just we have an increasing capacity to look close to regions of a black hole. We've got this Event Horizon telescope that is being built, hopefully within the next decade or so, that may allow us to probe very close to the event horizon around the black hole at the center of our galaxy. And what that will allow us to do is to test the validity of general relativity in these very high, strong field limits. And maybe that will give us, if we're fortuitous, there may be pulsars or something that will allow us to do very detailed tests that may allow us to show, to reveal some of those quantum effects of general quantum effects that general relativity or that might modify it, and it will help us come closer to that more complete theory. Along with the gravity wave telescopes, there's also LIGO is one that's actually looking to detect the gravity waves, and it's not the right kind of gravity waves for the Big Bang. But again, it's just moving us along towards that data we need to really assess what's going on. I just draw a blank. There was another one that I had. Oh, no, going back to the LHC, I concur that this is not really, it's probing particle physics, but I do think, it has the capacity to maybe actually make some dark matter, which would inform us of what's going on in the universe and give us a better picture. So, or maybe even begin to probe some of these extra dimensions. There's all these ideas of what might be going on that it's just difficult to get experimental data that constrains those ideas. So if we're able to test general relativity in the strong field or find the gravitational waves or find the dark matter or explore these extra dimensions, if they exist or not, or tell us what kind of Higgs boson it is, all those are pieces that help in some sense constrain what sort of ideas might be legitimate out there. But again, it comes back to, until we know what that quantum theory of gravity is, or can rule out some of the ideas we have, it's going to be difficult to answer this question in any sort of definitive way.
I mean, my fear is always that whatever they do, they'll end up creating a black hole and we'll all be sucked into nothingness or something. But I that's probably more Star Trek than
reality. I mean, the universe itself is a powerful particle accelerator, so we yes. we don't have to worry about that at all because the universe is doing these experiments for us.
Yeah, our most powerful particle accelerators are still a million times weaker than what happens every day in the cosmos.
Sure, so. Of course, yes, as is the case with most human inventions, I suppose. But anyway, great discussion. We're going to have another quick break and we'll just wrap up today's topic. I hope that it's been as informative for you as it has been for me. I'm learning some science as well as having some interesting theological discussions along the way today with my guests Phil and Jeff, who joined me to talk about whether God is behind the Big Bang. We'll be back in a moment's time to finish up today's discussion.
Welcome back to the final part of this Saturday's Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Again, if you want to find out more about the show, look at some of the resources and various videos and the links to the podcast and everything else that's on offer at the webpage, simply go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Lots of people listen every week via the podcast, and I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts about today's show. If you want to email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or equally leave some comments underneath today's show at the website. You can also follow me via Unbelievable on Facebook and Twitter at UnbelievableJB, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. Later on today, we are going to be hearing from Noel Robinson on The Profile. That's between 4 and 5 as part of Faith Explored. And equally, if you want to listen next week on the programme, then you're going to be hearing a discussion between two philosophers. Cesar Bernstein is an up-and-coming young theistic philosopher, and he's taking on Cambridge atheist philosopher Arif Ahmed. That'll be a real battle of minds as they debate consciousness and whether we are more than matter. That is the particular thing that Cesar is doing his PhD in at Oxford at the moment. And he, I've been told, is quite a debater and a philosopher to boot. So it'll be interesting to hear those two on the show at the same time next week. Always aim to bring you interesting high-level debate here on Unbelievable, and that's what we've been hearing on today's show. So before we go to some of your feedback, let's finish off this conversation between my guests today, Jeff and Phil.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So concluding today's discussion on the Big Bang and whether God was behind it, Phil Harper and Jeff Zwierink have been joining me. And it should be said at the outset, I should have mentioned this right at the beginning, really. You guys, this isn't the first time you've met. You were able to have a chat with Jeff at Unbelievable Conference last year, weren't you, Phil? You
came. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. We had a really nice chat. I thought Jeff was the smartest guy in the room, and I thought, that's the guy I want to talk to. You know, I could have tried to challenge William Lane Craig.
Yeah, I noticed you didn't come to talk to me either, so that
says
a lot.
Well, no, I did talk to you first, don't you
no,
remember?
That's true.
And we did have a little bet, actually, which I did win on cosmology, so maybe you can buy me a beer next time you see me.
All right, what bet was this? Just explain.
So there was a really interesting, exciting story about these... maybe they'd actually detected a signal of these gravitational waves.
Oh, I remember. This was about the beginning of last year.
Yeah, April last year.
They were saying, oh, we've seen the gravitational waves. It's evidence for the Big Bang.
It would be evidence for inflation, although even that I would dispute because actually you need to measure the spectrum of these gravitational waves, which even that they weren't really claiming.
So you had a bet. What was
that? What I basically said was, I think this is not going to stand up. And the reason I said that, it's because there's this number that they measure called R. Mm. And they had basically said R was 0.2. And the Planck spacecraft, they couldn't necessarily pronounce on this yet, but they said, well, it can't be higher than 0.1. We don't know what it is, but it's not higher than 0.1. And I thought, well, I'm going to bet on Planck and not against these guys.
And as it turned out, it was a misreading of some kind?
Yeah, basically the signal was contaminated by dust in our galaxy. So all they were seeing was dust in our galaxy, probably. I mean, you know, nothing certain in science. So there's always a chance they did see the signal.
Yeah, you can't say it was all dust because there is still a signal. It's just not significant enough to detect. But I agree with your point that it's probably going to be somewhere, or, you know, the R value of whatever that signal is now down less than one. So I've already admitted in private, at least, that you were correct there. So
you owe Phil a drink now. Let's just as we start to conclude today's program, gentlemen. I think you had a question for Phil, Jeff, which was along the lines of, would Phil be happier at some level with an eternal universe rather than one that has a beginning? Why did you want to ask that?
Well, it seems to me that the fact that we're here needs some sort of explanation. And, you know, I like the explanation where there's a beginning and there's God as that ultimate eternal being. It seems like Phil's more comfortable or would rather have there be an eternal universe. And I'm curious what, if there's a reason why that is, or am I misreading things there?
Okay, so it is a slight misreading, maybe. I mean, okay, so I would love to know I always really wanted to know, is the universe eternal into the past or not? Is it infinite spatially or not? And I've always really wanted to know the answer. I'm not sure we'll ever know the answer. And I think when I sort of read more about these quantum gravity ideas and how uncertain we really were about whether there was a beginning or not, then I contrasted that with the confidence that not just Christian apologists, but Muslim apologists and even some secular scientists were saying, yeah, we know the universe had a beginning. That just, it didn't gel with me. I'm like, that doesn't sound right. And so I guess I do want to show the alternative that really we don't know. We really have no evidence there was a beginning at all. We have lots of evidence there was some kind of Big Bang event, but we really don't know what the nature of this event was. And so I guess I'm kind of pushing the alternative just to show, you know, we don't know, rather than I really want it to be eternal.
Would it, but for you, even if you could show, even if someone eventually proved you wrong and said, actually, yeah, it really did, there was a beginning and so on, for you, that wouldn't particularly make you think, oh, I better reconsider the options on God then?
No, I mean, the reason for that, I think, is that, well, it's interesting. Let me give you an example from science. When we were interviewing one of our cosmologists, we were asking, why do you think inflation theory is so impressive, you know, why is everyone so convinced about it? And he said, you know what, you put in, what you get out is so much more than what you put in. And you make a very small set of assumptions and you can explain so many things. Now, I agree that God can explain absolutely everything. But the problem is you have to assume absolutely everything. You have to assume there's a being that can do everything. And so, of course, you can explain everything. So what you put in is exactly what you get out. And therefore, I just don't find it convincing.
You don't find it a satisfactory explanation.
Right. I would like something like inflation. What you get out is more than what you put in.
Jeff, any thoughts on that yourself? Because obviously for you, you have found God to be a good explanation for the, not just, you know, and obviously your interests range wider than just the Big Bang, but for a whole set of experiences, I suppose, both personal and scientific, that for you show that this is a good explanation.
Yeah, and I guess I would characterize it a little different way. As I don't look at this and say, okay, you know, as I look in, I'm going to expect to find miracles as I'm doing my science. What I find appealing about God is that, okay, the fact that we're here needs an explanation. Either we're just a random, or you know, we're the result of a bunch of physical processes at work. But then the question comes, okay, so why are there these physical processes? You know, it seems there's got to be something that just simply exists in and of themselves. And either it's the physical realm, or there is a God, or some, you know, something more personal, if you will. And yeah, exactly. And so I find that, as I understand the God of Christianity, that not only does it answer why does the universe work the way it does, but it also answers the question of why can I study the universe? Why am I able to understand it? Why is it so regular and orderly? That's it provides a philosophical grounding, and I find that very attractive, so that I can have the freedom to go into the lab and ask the question, what's really going on here? And can I find a good understanding of this using the laws of physics that we understand? So,
yeah, we are kind of drawing to a close now. So any final thoughts, Phil, as we start to
it seems to me that Jeff is actually on the same page, that we're in agreement that we really don't know whether the universe had a beginning. And that's, I think, a big misconception that a lot of theists promote, including, I think, some of Jeff's colleagues at Reasons to Believe. You know, it's a much more uncertain picture. And I hope that people will come away with that idea that, you know, it's a very exciting process that science is going to progress and maybe answer these questions. We will have to wait and see. But we certainly don't think that they're settled at the moment.
Mm. Jeff, any final thoughts from you?
Well, and I would agree with Phil. I think there is an uncertainty in that. But I also think there is a lot, the dominant scientific narrative that people talk about is that scientists have somehow removed any sort of reason to believe in God. And while I think there's uncertainty, I think it's also a very rational thing to believe that God exists and created the universe, even in spite of the uncertainty. So,
well, we're going to have to draw it to a close there. It's been really interesting. I hope whether you're listening via the radio or via your iPod or online, that you've been able to follow along as well. And I think you both did a great job, actually, at keeping it, you know, sponge analogies for quantum, you know, particles and things. It all helps to help people like me who really wouldn't have the foggiest clue if you actually started talking the technical language. But it's been really interesting. So thank you for being on the show, both of you.
Thank you, guys.
Look forward to...
Thank you, Justin.
Good. And look forward to responses as well. We'll be hearing some of your responses to emails in just a moment. Time, but if you want to get in touch about today's program, as ever, simply drop me a line to unbelievable@premier.org.uk or get in touch via the website at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Thanks for listening, and we're going to be hearing some of your feedback in a moment's time.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, time for some of your feedback now. And again, if you want to get in touch, I'd be delighted to hear from you. The email is unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can follow me via Facebook and Twitter at UnbelievableJB for the Twitter account, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB if you want to do it via Facebook. Thanks to Kelly, who got in touch via the Facebook and left me a message to say I was introduced to your show through Phil Vischer's podcaster. Phil, I know you listen regularly as well, so hello to you as well. You say you're hooked, Kelly. Love the thoughtful give and take and challenges to so many important ideas that are breathing new life into my faith. Thank you for making me feel less like a unicorn among my evangelical American suburbanite friends. It doesn't hurt, of course, that I lived in Britain for 9 years as a teen and so enjoy hearing familiar voices that I miss a great deal. Thank you, says Kelly. Thank you, Kelly, for writing in. Grace also got in touch via Facebook to say, I've been fascinated by and keen to learn more about annihilationism in the last year and hugely appreciated your programme on it, which I urge everyone to listen to if they've missed it. I believe it's a serious issue since I frequently hear individuals who reject Christianity say that part of their reason for so doing is wanting nothing to do with a God who would send those who don't believe in him to eternal suffering, as though they would stop God from existing by avoiding him. It's ironic, of course, given that annihilationists believe that the eternal torment concept was supported or popularized by the church largely as a means of scaring people into continuing to attend and that tradition. I wonder what impact it would have on the growth or demise of Christianity in the UK today if the annihilationist view was the majority position of the church and this was known to non-Christians. Might fewer people view God as cruel and thus be more inclined to try exploring Christianity? Obviously, I'm not necessarily proposing the church should do this, as I've not studied the issue enough to be certain of the truth. I'm just pondering. Anyway, you go on later on in your email to say, last year you polled Christians and non-Christians on what Christians mean by faith. I'd love it if you do more polls, and it's great to uncover misunderstandings between opposing views so that we can have more helpful dialogue. As just one example, I think a poll on the Christian views of what comes after death would be fascinating. What proportion of Christians actually believe in eternal torment, and what proportion of atheists believe eternal torment to be a crucial part of Christianity, and has it affected their choosing not to be Christian? But I'm sure that you or other listeners could think of better poll questions than me. Anyway, thank you very much, Grace. It's always lovely to hear messages from you. You're obviously someone who thinks through things a great deal. Sorry I couldn't read all of your email, but good to hear from you nonetheless. Let's talk about the show of a couple of weeks ago in which we talked to John Walton, who's professor of Old Testament at Wheaton College, Illinois, about his book, The Lost World of Adam and Eve, and his particular view of the early chapters of Genesis. He was in debate with Stephen Lloyd, a young earth creationist, for that programme. And effectively, you could say that John Walton's view boils down to the idea that Adam and Eve isn't simply about a first human couple, it's really about an archetype for humanity in that story. So anyway,
number of people left comments underneath the show online. So here's Justin in Pittsburgh, who says, thanks again for an interesting show. I was surprised, though, at how aggressively, one might even say caustically, Stephen Lloyd, the young Earth creationist, came out of the gate. One question that's been bouncing around my head for the last couple of months is the relation between in-person and distance debates. Certainly, you would be in a better place than me to judge, but from where I'm sitting, it seems that your debaters tend to be more generous and less aggressive and more respectful when they're sitting in the same room. The distance created by the computer screen or the telephone seems to foster a more combative and unhelpfully dismissive tenor. Steve Chalk and Ed Shaw's discussion, for example, seemed to be an example of a recent episode where physical presence encouraged a respectful demeanour. Interesting comment there, Justin, that you make. I'm not sure it does make a huge difference. I mean, for instance, another show where, you know, one person was on the line, one person with me in studio would have been that one between Michael Roos and Keith Ward. And many people said how very, you know, friendly and fun and everything that interaction was. So I think it really depends to some extent upon the people themselves and what kind of a flavour they want to bring to it. Though I would agree with you that it is probably harder to be too, you know, in your face when you're sitting next to someone. You tend to not go for it quite so much, do you, necessarily? Here's Daniel, who says, I found Stephen Lloyd's last point about the problem of evil odd. He says the only answer to this question is the answer that sin corrupted the world. But there are lots of answers to the problem of evil. One main one is that God and evil existing are not an explicit contradiction. If you try to make it a contradiction, you have to assume two problematic and impossible to prove premises: that God would do differently if he existed, and God has no sufficient reasons to allow evil. Well, the first is difficult to prove, since we would be assuming a free agent would make a certain choice, and are assuming that this is not the best world, or that there is a better world that God could have chosen. The second premise essentially commits us to know that there will be no good reason for this evil occurring. Well, there's no way we humans can know this fact, given chaos theory. How could we possibly know any of that, let alone all of that? The proponent of the problem of evil has to make more of a case than simply posing a simple question that has many answers. Michael Brady is a skeptic, and he got in on the discussion to say John Walton's concept has a very strange cobbled together sense to it, as though he deconstructed the story, which has been easily understood for several millennia, but then couldn't reconnect the pieces. I agree that Genesis is best read in its own context rather than by the Christian method of reading the New Testament into and over it. But after that, the wheels fall off. In an ironic turn of events, John's ideas are so strange that Stephen's young earth creationism made more sense. Still, John and Stephen skip the most obvious interpretation of Genesis 1-3 as a creation myth. And DandBJ13, who's another regular contributor on the Unbelievable website in the comments section, says that he completely agrees with you there, Michael. The thing is, I think when it comes to how the story is meant to be taken, I think Lloyd is right. The rest of the Bible treats it as a literal creation story. You can't do a literal genealogy starting from mythical characters. You can't have a literal redemption story based on a mythical fall. So there you go. But Sean Pendley has a different take on this, and he weighs in to this argument online about the show. He says, I had quite a different reaction to the show, both on the level of general impression and of specific points of argumentation. Walton's point about biblical archetypes is that they signify at one and the same time a specific historical figure / place / event and an idea of some greater import. So the distinction you're drawing between specific figures and larger ideas isn't one I feel he would endorse. Only if it can be established that his archetypal and functional reading of Adam and Eve has no theological point can we accuse him of arbitrariness, but he does connect his reading to a guiding logic. Sounded to me that he adhered to a sort of creation fall redemption view. To call that arbitrary is to take liberties with the word. Perhaps the declaration of creation as good presents a challenge to his view, but perhaps it doesn't. Could not God have been declaring the ordered features of his creation, which are the subject of his creation narrative, good, while passing over the unordered features in silence? It wouldn't follow from such a reading that the unordered features of creation are morally evil. Neither did Walton endorse the view that death and disease were morally good. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not certain I buy his reading of Genesis, but it strikes me that a perfectly plausible, theologically sound understanding of Scripture could follow from a more charitable and perhaps more attentive ear to what was actually said. Finally, you say, I'd have to disagree with how many have taken his archetypal reading of the fall. He believes a literal fall occurred through a little couple at some definite point in history. None of it is merely figurative. He said as much. What he doesn't appear to believe is that they were perfect in some Greco-Roman Hesiod's theogony sense that Lloyd appears to subscribe to. In fact, I thought the great weakness of Walton's side of the debate was in failing to make this point more vividly. Anyway, thank you very much for all those interesting interactions on the website underneath that show between John Walton and Stephen Lloyd. Here's Rich, who emailed in to say, I think two crucial points emerged concerning the apparent misreading of Adam and Eve. The primary was the admission by John Walton that he doesn't read Genesis in light of the New Testament, but wants to understand it as the original author intended. Now, certainly, we want to understand text grammatical, historically, but which author is he concerned about? Does the authorship and intent of the Holy Spirit play at all in the reading and understanding of a text? I expect an unbelieving scholar to say no, but one who claims divine inspiration of the text? How does John Walton primarily come to a lexical and theological understanding of the Genesis words? Looking at the ancient Near Eastern context, on the one hand, he claims that he's not grounding his theological understanding by simply assuming that the author aped ancient Near Eastern thinking, but that's precisely what he ends up limiting the reading of those texts to. Presumably, the Holy Spirit himself could not have had a fuller understanding than the original author may have understood, which is why, in John's mind, he fails to comprehend why even the Genesis account must be read in the fullness of Revelation rather than simply assuming that the original author's use of words can give us a theology that is limited to the understanding of what ancient Near Eastern thinkers had in the region. You go on to say the second telling part is the danger of over-specialisation. The, oh, gee, I don't understand what N.T. Wright wrote about the New Testament is precisely the problem. I'm thankful that there was at least one person in discussion who understands the pastoral and larger systematic problems. John thinks he can just come up with whatever conclusions he wants, but then feels no obligation to see whether those conclusions have any implications on the disciplines he ignores. So shame on you, John Walton, concludes Rich Linio. And from Enfield, Dr. Majid Khatmi writes in to say, just to let you know, 3 million British Muslims and 1,600 million Muslims in the world believe strongly in the creation of Adam and Eve as the beginning of mankind. Muslims do not believe in the false theory of evolution, says Majid Khatmi. So I don't know if that's just a comment on the fact that Christians are more divided than perhaps Muslims are over the Adam and Eve story. But thanks for letting me know. I'd be interested in further responses to that Adam and Eve episode, and I'll try to read some out in future editions of the programme if you want to send them in to me. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. So we did a subject as well, a podcast special with the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, an interview that we aired with him on Premier Radio about evangelism and witness, and then his Lambeth address on the subject. It was a lot of good response from that, from people on Twitter who particularly enjoyed hearing that, a little bit different to what we normally air on Unbelievable. Not everyone enjoyed it, who responded online. Martin said, sloppy, sentimental Christianity, as we've come to expect from archbishops. He really needs to learn what the gospel is and that they cannot choose Christ, for they are dead in their sins. I hadn't realised that the recording contained a lecture. It's interesting how muddled the archbishop is. On the one hand, he speaks of God choosing, and then he speaks of the sinner choosing. As the 39 articles clearly state, it is God who chooses, it is God who saves. God is the one who causes the sinner to turn to him. God is the one who gives faith, just as God is the one who saves. Peter O'Brien responded to you, Martin, said that's quite a dissing of the Catholic Church. It is sad, sickening and pathetic that so many of the religious groups in this world can't get along or look down on each other, have endless wars and violence, and all claim that their God is the real one, when there have been thousands of gods in the history of mankind, and no evidence that any of them are real. Kirkatori comes in to say, Martin, what would you rather have? More melodrama? More bombastic anger? More you're gonna burn in hell diatribes? I found his calm and tranquil demeanour refreshing. The Archbishop of Canterbury was smooth and had a resolute self-possession about him. Actually, in the reciprocal and relational coalescence of free will and determinism, it's a bit of both, where God draws and we accept, and vice versa. For God to create a universe where true love can be experienced requires that we not be automata. I wouldn't worry too much about the Roman Catholic Church. It will take care of itself. I can't help but see a similarity between the 39 articles of 1563 you've mentioned and the play The 39 Steps, where a handful of actors play all the leading roles simultaneously. The whole plot becomes a farcical nonsense, though, almost schizophrenical character changes. The 39 articles themselves are all helpfully and theologically astute, but systematically unachievable and often deliberately anti-Anabaptist. Okay, there you go. Some of the responses that there were underneath that that episode of Unbelievable recently. Thanks to others Ralph, very short email, says, thanks for the show. It is so funny. One of the funniest programs I've ever heard. It always makes me smile and laugh. I don't know why. It just does. Okay. And here's Trevor Logan, who says, thanks for your radio program. I admire the ease and fairness with which you conduct conversations. I just have a couple of requests. I don't know if it's possible to get on your show the Christian philosopher René Girard, but I think that if you did, it would be very interesting to have a conversation on religious violence. Or perhaps Edward Fesser or Dennis Turner at Yale or Stephen R.L. Clarke, University of Liverpool, could come on the show and clarify that monotheism is not simply polytheism reduced to one, which is a popular category error that I encounter in many casual dismissals of monotheism. In fact, Dennis Turner would be great in a discussion on the Trinity. Or maybe have John Milbank dialogue with someone about secularism. And one more request. I often hear Christians are hostile to pagan myth and culture. This is a great myth, since it was predominantly Christian culture that preserved them. Maybe resurrecting C.S. Lewis or Tolkien would provide a great conversation dispelling this alleged hostility. That said, maybe a show on Christianity and pagan myth would be good. I mention these because I seem to stumble upon these objects in conversations with people of all educational levels and ages, and it's hard to find a good, clear conversations about them, other than books, of course. Anyway, Trevor, great suggestions, and they will be put in the thinking pot, the unbelievable thinking pot, which I stir occasionally and occasionally draw things out of. But anyway, it's lovely to have all the input, both whether people are responding to shows or suggesting topics and guests for future shows. I do appreciate them. Why not let me know what you think about today's show? And you can do that by emailing in or sending me a message on Facebook or Twitter or directly on the show page. Be interested to hear from you. For the moment, let me tell you what's coming up next
You're
week.
Unbelievable.
Well, next week we're going to be looking at another philosophical argument. We do a number of them here on the show that aims to get you thinking. And next week it's all about the consciousness, human consciousness. Can we account for that on an atheistic worldview? Are we more than matter? We certainly are, says Cesar Bernstein. He's an up-and-coming young theistic philosopher, quite the debater as well, and he'll be taking on Arif Ahmed, who is a fearsome opponent as far as the atheist philosophers out there go. He's from Cambridge. He's been on the show a few times, and so if you're a regular listener, you may be familiar with him. But they'll be doing battle on Unbelievable this time next week. Hope you can join me for it too. Until then, have a great week.